Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
When I was with the circus, I worked with time. I watched how important split-second timing was for acrobatic acts and the timing of a dangerous act, like the tightrope walker or the lion and tiger acts. The timing of a clown gag was important. The timing of scheduling cities to perform in, as we were a large tented show that traveled overnight by truck three times a week to get to the next city. And the timing of the advertising and promotion campaigns to bring people to the circus. Timing for the acts, though, was life and death timing. Timing for the marketing campaigns that I coordinated meant financial survival through ticket sales. In everyday life, we hear people say, timing is everything, and yes, it is. And when we're in the middle of a divorce, timing is really crucial. The timing of how we respond to our attorneys, our mediators, the court, and our soon-to-be exes when they may write toxic texts and emails to us. Timing is also the centerpiece of our guest's message in his book, Take 10. You are only 10 seconds away from a human connection. I welcome you, Kevin Barclay, to the program.
Thank you for having me, Judy. It's wonderful to be here.
And it's going to be a wonderful conversation. I know that. So before we discuss the book, which we are going to give, no pun intended, the lion's share of the time to, Kevin, you were twice divorced, thrice married.
Yes, that's true.
So
to have the stars to show it.
Well... Don't we all, even though we try and minimize the damage, don't we all? So for that human connection between you and the audience, before we talk about your book, can you just share a little bit of those two divorce processes, what you did that you're proud of that you would like to give to our audience, and if there was something you wish you could have done over again to help our audience?
Sure. Well, at 21 years old was my first marriage, and I got married because, you know, I was in the church, and I thought that because we were having sex that I had to get married. So that was the case. And then, you know, 23 years later, I had my first son, and 24 years later, I had my second son. And after the marriage started going a little rocky and started getting distant, I didn't really invest much into it. And at the end of that marriage, I found out that she was seeing someone else and kind of made sense. And we were real avid churchgoers. And I shook my hand at God saying, how could you make this happen? And as I look back in the regrets of that, I probably should have seen the signs a lot earlier. I wasn't paying attention. I was just doing my job, head down, butt up, working as hard as I could. So that's something, that was the direction I was taking there. So any regrets there is, I could have paid a little more attention to the signs, read the signs, been aware.
But how about the divorce process itself?
It was a train wreck. It was, give her everything she wants. I'm out of here. I don't care.
Did you do that? Give her what she wants?
Yes.
Okay, so this is great. I love hearing people say that. And I'll tell you why. Sitting in my position as a divorce mediator, the easiest divorces are ones where people don't fight over every penny.
Right.
And it's wonderful. I don't hear it enough. And, you know, there can be some variation to give her what or give him whatever he wants. But just that attitude, it makes things a lot easier to move forward. So please, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Continue.
Oh, no worries. The regret I have is that I told my children, at the time of the divorce, 14 and 13-year-old boys who are beautiful young men right now, very proud of them, where they're at. I told them it was all my fault. And I took the heat for it because I always thought about men and their mothers was such an important bond, and that I'd come along. And actually, it worked out pretty good at the end. My 35-year-old son, well, when my older son was 35, he called me up and said, "You were a great dad." And I found out all the things that happened. So my relationship with my sons now could never be better. But taking the high road sometimes doesn't pay itself in the beginning, but it does work itself out in the end.
It does. I think it's horrible and a waste of time to talk to our children about the issues because it's not their issue.
It isn't. And so that's my regret.
Okay.
My second marriage happened. It also was not a choice I made. I felt like it was made for me. She says, "Why don't I move in with you? Why don't we get married and everything else?" And turns out she was absolutely opposite in the beginning of my wife. She was an atheist. She was, you know, I had different thoughts and everything else. Like that. It was just odd how all that went. I was raised the kids a different way. So here I am in this relationship. And at the end of that marriage, and I said to myself, "I'm going to fight. I'm going to get in there and I'm going to fight." I knew, I had good money then. Really got to a good level of income. I'm going to fight this thing. And what she wanted was enormous. For somebody of my stature, it's almost like I worked in Hollywood or something. And I said, "No, I'm fighting this. There's no way I'm going to do this." And sure enough, she got what she wanted at the end. Because I can't stand the fighting and the bickering and I want this and that. And But, there's recovery at the end of that. And so during that process, I shouldn't have fought so much. I should have tried to find some middle ground. And back then, during that time, there wasn't any type of mediation at all. It was just me and her and our attorneys and stuff and going back and forth and, throwing salvos at each other. At the end of that, though, I ended up doing what she wanted and went on my merry way and thought, that's it. Two divorces under my belt. And I'm like, what do I do now? So that was challenging at the end of that.
Did you have children in the second marriage?
Nope. There was no children in the second marriage. She didn't want any children. And I wanted to be able to spend time with my children. I would have to raise more children, during that time.
Was the blended family aspect of going into the second marriage with two children difficult at all?
Oh, absolutely. It really was. She wouldn't hear of it. She kind of liked my boys, but my boys didn't like her. And so it was pretty challenging going back and forth. So I had a challenging time with that. And she came around near the end, but there were certain aspects about her personality that I wasn't aware of when it showed up. It was challenging for me, and along with the kids and everything else like that, it kind of created a bit of a challenge.
Not everybody's set up to be a parent. That's one of the things that we talk about a lot, and that is, we assume we're going to do certain things. We just take what we are told culturally, religiously, familially, and do without thinking. And then all of a sudden, we're in the middle of a life that really isn't serving us well.
Oh, I can't say that better. Judith, the whole thing is, a lot of times we have no clue what's going on. And we're in our own little world, moving forward at some incredible pace, thinking we have to get to someplace. Like, we are on this journey, and we have to get to this point. It's like, come on, let's go. And if we pause, if we slow down just a little bit, man, it would help so much.
Do you know who Eckhart Tolle is?
Oh, I love him. Love him.
I know.
Present. Being present. So important.
And he talks in such a calm way that you just start breathing differently if you're listening to one of his interviews, don't you?
Yeah. And then he rings that little bell. Ding. I always thought that'd be great to have in real life, because he has a little, when he ends a comment or something, go ding, and then everybody be calm. Like, maybe everybody needs one of those little bells.
Well, we all need people in our lives who are calmer than us if we are more type A or more high energy or prone to reacting quicker. And I look at relatives that I have that really are slow to anger. And I try and keep them top of mind in front of me when I get hyper, because I get hyper.
No, me too.
Yeah. Okay. So now let's talk about the book, because I really, really love the book. I love the concept of the book. And let's look at the title a second, and let's look at a little bit of the description that I got. It's on Amazon for everybody. Sure. That I got off of Amazon. So take 10. You are only 10 seconds away from a human connection. And then as I was reading the description of the book, here's the paragraph that I love that I really found had relevancy to these discussions about divorce. We are 10 seconds away from making a better decision. Many people have said that a situation could have turned out differently had they paused and given it more thought. So I love that. And then when I look at the human connection aspect of your book, I look at divorce and I say, well, we are disconnecting from the person that we're married to. But if we have children, we really can't disconnect.
Yeah.
So let's talk about all of this. First of all, why did you write the book?
We had written in my third marriage, we had a thing called Christmas Crafty. And I'm not good at like putting things together like vases or anything else like that or doing pictures. But I love to write. So I wrote a chapter on Benefit of the Doubt, which is the first chapter, and I passed it out to everybody. And then in 2008, I developed a talk, Be Great in 2008. So that's the last seven chapters of my book, and it's an acronym. You know, gratitude, respect, empathy, adaptability, you know, all of that. So
now, wait a minute. Go slower. Say it again. Okay. Say the word as an acronym. That was wonderful.
Okay. Be great. So G is for gratitude. Having gratitude in your life. And in my talks that I would give people, I'd give them a little rock. This is to remind you. Put it in your pocket or purse. Take it out at the end of the day. Put it back in the morning. And use it as a reminder for gratitude. Respect. At the end of the day, Judith, we could get rid of all of this turmoil in the world and do one thing and respect one another. Even in divorce, we could respect each other. It would be so much more amicable. And wouldn't that be better for your children and friends and family?
And respect. You.
Empathy. We've lost that. It's being wiped off of our personality. It's like it's disappearing from our DNA somehow. Empathy is so important. That provides the connection that's so important and so something that we need, and it connects us with one another. Adaptability and adversity kind of go together, because when you have adversity, you have to be able to adapt. A lot of times people don't do that. Adapt, being flexible. How important is that? One person wants it one way, adapt, be flexible. And the most important one to me is time. You know, we only have 24 hours a day. And if you think about it, at the end of life, what do people say? I wish I had more time. I wish I had more time with you. I wish I had more time in my life. I could have done this or that. So that's the great acronym that I spoke on, you know, several times. I don't know how many times. Schools and businesses. And even to this day, people come up and say, I still have my rock. So it's kind of fun.
I love that. You know, every letter, every word in this acronym of the word great, it really does apply to divorce. Divorce is, of course, one of the hardest experiences we will go through for so many different reasons, right?
Well, even if you really need it or want it desperately, it's still something that's a horrible event. One of life's biggest challenges, of course, you have to go through.
Yeah, and I always say the only way I can get through life, and this is from a child, I realized, well, the concept of fair is a fallacy.
Yeah, right.
The concept of we get what we need to learn, that for me is reality. And therein lies the fairness doctrine. The fairness doctrine, I think, is individual. There's no one fairness doctrine for everybody. It's, okay, so did this horrible thing that just happened to me, fair, that's inappropriate. What am I supposed to learn from it? That seems more appropriate. Is that kind of how you look at it?
Absolutely. You know, I look at fairness like a teeter-totter. You know, it's my way, no, your way, my way, no, no. What's fair is even, but it is different for each person. So how do you even measure that? You know, when I give up on stuff like that, when I'm negotiating, and you know, I did that for years and years, negotiating. When I'm negotiating, I look at a couple things. One is the fight worth fighting? Is it worth fighting? Am I ready to do this fight? And at the end, is it going to be worth it? And another question I have is, can I win the fight? Is it really challenging? And then the word we talked about a while back when we visited, what will it serve? If we had that mantra on our mirror, in our bathroom, when we go wake up and go to sleep at night, just put it at the top on your, if you're listening to this, put it on the top of your mirror. Use it as your mantra. What will it serve? If you do that, measure everything you do throughout the day, you'll have a more balanced day. Because then you'll say, this is important to me. It'll serve this. Or no, this is not important. It won't serve anything.
What did you do as a negotiator?
I was in the car business for years. I was in management for 30 years and 10 years before that. And I was known as one of the best closers most people saw. And the reason for that is I love people. I'm not much of a car guy. 40 years in the car business, you're thinking, oh, I love cars. No. I love people. And I love the challenge of talking to new people. I love the challenge of people that first glimpse don't like me because I'm a large guy or because I'm a car guy or anything else like that. But I used to love the negotiation part of it because it's so easy to get to an even place, I believe. Especially in a purchase. Now, in a marriage, a whole different thing. But in that place, if you're just aware and you watch and you're present, you know, you listen to and you listen and you hear them and you see them talk and you feel what they're feeling, it makes it so much easier.
You know, what you said a minute ago, is it worth it, the fight? And is it winnable, the fight? And that's what people go through if they don't have an amicable divorce or, you know, even what constitutes amicable. In my book, when I tell people I work on amicable divorces, the only thing they need to be able to do is communicate. And if you can't communicate sitting at a table, you really have to hire attorneys and then they'll communicate for you and at least it gets the job done. And at the end of the day, but so interesting when people represent themselves, even if they have legal counsel on the side for the divorce and they're at the mediation table, there may have been a power imbalance in the relationship. And there quite often is. So if there's a power imbalance, quite often the person who has less power, meaning they have less money, they weren't the ones who earned the money, but they're the ones asking for alimony and other things, child support, alimony, et cetera.
Right.
Quite often, they'll just throw up their hands and say, I don't even care anymore. Please give him or her, whoever has the power, whatever they want. I just want it over.
Right.
What do you say to those people? How should they take stock?
So I was in that position both times. I didn't really know her financial background as much as I found out later, which was a big surprise.
Surprised that it was a lot less, surprised that it was a lot more.
A lot more.
A lot more.
So it was more about doing damage. I would say the first thing is do your research. Make sure you're not surprised at the table. Make sure that her attorney is not wearing a $3,000 suit. Because if that's the case, then you're in bigger trouble than you think. You'll put in your part. So I think number one, do research. Make sure that, you know, if you're getting a divorce, part of it is you don't really know the person. And the second thing is, you know, what's really at stake here? What are you giving up and how does it affect you? So do your research and then look at your resources. Because at the end of the day, divorce is an emotional thing. And if you're tied up in the emotional aspect of it, you forget about the resource part of it. Now, our attorneys and our mediators, thank you, Judith, are there to help us. Hey, think about this or that. But since it's so emotional, you don't even hear those words. All you hear is, she's going to do this and I'm going to do that to her. I think be calm and measured. Being calm and measured is a funny thing. Being calm, first of all, in a situation like this seems counterintuitive. But if you can be calm enough to truly hear and then measure it, and measure to me sometimes is don't bring a knife to a gunfight. So that's why you have to do your research and then have that information for you. So I think those are important things.
Okay, here are your steps. I'm reading again from you. Take 10 breaths, take 10 steps. That doesn't probably necessarily mean steps. I want you to explain that.
Sure.
And just take 10 meaning pause. So help us apply that concept to when the emotions take over the divorce.
Yeah. So 10 seconds, 10 steps, and 10 breaths. So the first thing, 10 seconds, you know, goes by so fast. But one of the things I like people to think about is time is relative to everything that we do. I don't have enough time to finish this, or I don't have time to sit and do the divorce or anything else like that. 10 seconds was more like a measurement of sorts. It's also, I equate it to drive, to road rage. If you take 10 seconds in any road rage situation, it's over with. And it's so easy to see how times like emotions can pass. So in a mediation, if you take 10 seconds or something like that, it'd be over with quicker than you even know. The 10 steps is walking away from a situation that you're embroiled in, where the person that you might have a conflict with has the upper edge because they're on their home turf. Taking 10 steps could be walking away from that, inviting them on that journey. If you take 10 steps and you say, please come with me, take 10 steps with me. You turn around, not turn your back on them, but you walk 10 steps and they follow you. What's just happened is you're taking 10 steps or more than 10 seconds, give or take 22, 25 seconds, to rethink how you're going to approach it. And they're following you thinking, where are they taking me? In a relationship like that, it's really good to get them away from the kids, maybe outside in the waiting room, away from the attorneys. Whatever the case is, you take 10 steps, depart from that. The 10 breaths is really designed for domestic issues. 10 deep breaths, we breathe in through our nose and out through our mouth, tells our brain, or our brain tells us when we take a deep breath like that, hey, slow down, fella, what's going on? That typically takes a person 42 to 46 seconds. If you're hyperventilating in a divorce, it might only take you 15, but 10 deep breaths like that, cleansing breaths, can help us calm ourselves so we can be calm and measured. So if you're in a mediation, it doesn't mean you have to keep talking and responding. You could take a moment and put your head down and just breathe deeply, just a little bit, to gather yourself back up, to calm yourself so you can be calm and measured. Calmness creates connection, creates some type of thing that everybody can handle. You know, there should be another C word in there somewhere. When I started saying it, it didn't come out, but I can say this. Somebody who's calm is going to resolve the situation. Somebody who's excited could just exacerbate the whole deal. So being calm in the room is the best.
So I'm thinking back to mediations, either my mediations or what people share with their other mediators share about their mediations. And I've noticed that in some of the more emotional mediations, I have been asked to step out of the room so that the couple can talk by themselves. And I encourage this, by the way. I set this up before we even start, and I say, if it gets emotional, if you need just some space to think for a second, or if you want to air some idea for settlement with me before presenting it to your spouse, we can take a walk. What that looks like in a mediation is we can caucus. One person, the other person will leave the room and I'll sit with the one person who wants to air their thinking. But conversely, I say to them, if you would like me to leave the room at some point so that both of you can have your own private dialogue that you don't even want to share with me, even though it's totally confidential, please ask for the room. I completely respect that process. And they do take advantage of it sometimes. And when I walk back in the room, it is a different energy.
Yeah, right.
I
find that very refreshing. I think that, you know, there's always good mediators and bad mediators and good attorneys, bad attorneys and stuff like that. But the couple at least know each other, and maybe there's a way they can calm each other down a little bit if they're not there. It's such a volatile situation. Having going through the two of those, I wouldn't wish it on anyone just to go through one of them. So, yeah.
I know. Even amicable, it's very, very difficult. It's an emotional game changer, and nobody should go without recognizing that it's an emotional game changer. I'll say it like that. But, you know, when the couple talks to themselves, you know, there are things that even they're not going to want to divulge to anybody except themselves, because it's so private. It's so intimate. And I love when they ask for the room. It doesn't happen a lot, but once in a while when it does, I like that. Let's talk about one of the most important times where people need to take 10 in a divorce, and that is the email or the text that comes through during the day when you're either at work or you're with the kids, and it's so not the time to respond. Let's talk about that. Please take that example. And
oh, gosh. I wish. I you know, the emails and the texts, I mean, first of all, you can't take them back. Like, you say the word, oh, you misheard me, I said this, or whatever, but it's in writing, it's right there. It's like, oh, that's when what will it serve really comes, you know, front and center. You know, we can't help ourselves afterward. Insulted by somebody who we loved and cherished for all these years, and dinners and dates and everything else like that. We can't help
ourselves. Burying their children or providing for children.
Yeah, right. I can't speak to the burying part, thankfully, but boy, I tell you, that's a rough ride. But I will say there was this union and now it's not. And the words that come out are like billboards in our mind, and they stick there forever. And I just encourage people, don't communicate that way, period. Don't do it. If you're going to be, and plus, you don't want to give them ammunition to show your children or friends, look what that guy sent. Look what she did. You know,
I mean, or nowadays, the lawyer or the judge. I mean, people do print out texts and emails. See what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. So I would say under those circumstances, and you know you're going there, just don't. Just don't respond. Don't do it. There's no reason, you know, because you're not going to, he's not going to look at something that, or she's not going to look at something you email and text and, oh my God, he's so right. It's horrible. I can't believe. They're not going to do that. They're only going to get madder and send something back.
Oh my God.
Or another thing might happen is you'll be the one sending, well, I'm going to show them what I think and this is what's going to happen. That's not going to make a difference. It isn't. It's only going to make it worse. So just don't. Don't do it. I don't see how that wins.
Take 10 minutes or 10 days, right? Let's bump up 10 exponentially.
Because I guarantee you there's a lot of us that have sent errant texts or emails, and then 10 minutes later, oh man, I could have said this, or I could have said that differently. You know, there's a lot of people that are short texter. I don't know, you or your followers might have friends like this, but you send a big long text and they only say two words. Well, there's a reason for that, because they don't have to, you know, if you ask them a question in two paragraphs and they just say, nope, you know, that's it. No is no. You don't have to, you know, have to expound on that. So, yeah, I would just say to, if you're in the middle of a divorce and you're doing the email texting thing, just back off. Don't do it. Maybe, you know, use a friend to be your little sounding board, because it becomes a billboard, not only in your divorce, not only with your attorney, not only with your kids and friends and families. It just haunts you forever. So don't.
Yes. What I like to say to people, and myself, by the way, there have been times where I've gotten emails that were very disconcerting. You don't have to respond.
Right, right.
You just don't have to. And you certainly don't have to now. And, but, you know, it's so hard to regulate ourselves, though. It's so hard. But, I just want to. That got me so angry. What if he does or she does what he or she says he's going to do? And it's like, oh my God, how do we control ourselves, Kevin?
Well, one of the things I talk about is radical distractions. In my book, I say
radical what?
A radical distraction.
Okay.
So I define a radical distraction as something that you don't typically do. Like if you go to the movies all the time, it's a distraction, but it's not a radical distraction. But maybe it's a place you haven't gone before. Maybe it's a hike. Maybe it's a show you haven't watched. Something different that takes you out of the here and now to a new experience. Something that you know, and even this is a prolonged situation. Radical distractions are really important. You know, go to a place, visit a place you've never been to or whatever the case is. You need to pull yourself away from that toxic relationship that's happening, the toxic surrounding. I almost mispronounced that twice, but really it's so important for us to remove us from that. And the way to do that really is just have something radical. You know, if you think about how in situations where you get distracted from something that's not good because a sound or a move or something like that, and you look over and then you're removed from that for a while, see what that does to you. It takes you out of that moment and puts you in a nicer place. And when, go ahead.
No. I was going to say, well, I totally understand that in a larger context, but when we get the emails and the text in that immediate context, how do we self-regulate?
Well, that's the breathing part again, and being present, you know, being present in your own self. You know, I'm guilty of that too. You know, I get a text from my wife that's mean-spirited or something happens or email, I have to respond to it right away. I say, put the phone down and step away from it and take 10. You know, if we can pause for a moment, like Eckhart Tolle preaches all the time, you know, it is that pause that refreshes us. You know, the escape using the radical distraction is a bigger picture, you're right, but the smaller condensed picture of like an immediate response, step away for a moment. Count to 10, take 10 steps, take 10 breaths, do something. Take 10 and take yourself away from that and allow yourself that moment. We have little stickers and everything else that we remind ourselves, take 10, you know, because that's something that we try to encourage people to do. Just take 10 for everything.
You know what? I like that. I think that could be a very cool practice that if you're going through a divorce and it's a little contentious or the communication is adversarial, maybe you could post around wherever your computer is, put a little post-it note, take 10. Maybe you could wear something, a little wristband or something, a little take 10 moment. Maybe you should be, okay, so for souvenirs and miscellaneous toys or things, you could be selling some take 10 wristbands.
Yeah.
Here's an idea.
I had some of those made up.
Did you?
We had some of them made up. They went pretty quick. It was amazing. And also little stickers. We have little stickers and big stickers that say just take 10 on them.
Okay, I think that's really good. And also just to set ourselves up for this is the relationship. It is kind of adversarial. I will be getting texts and emails. Just to set yourself up for that so that when they come through, it's not a shock.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And that's so big. I think that, you know, I think I'm an okay guy. I think I'm going to be amicable. I don't realize the triggers are going to be pulled. And going into it, forewarned is really a great thing.
Okay, now here's something else really great in your book, and I want you to address that. I think it's chapter 3, and it's three things. It's about listening. You say, listen to hear, listen to see, listen to feel. Love that. Explain that, please.
So you could read big books on being an active listener and stuff, but I one thing about my book, I like to condense it because I always say, what if the answer is so simple it's hard? And really, listening, we hear, when somebody talks, we hear, and hopefully your hearing's okay. So we listen to hear. If somebody says something, we hear it. But what we miss, 85% of communication is nonverbal. What we miss, if we're not looking at the person, then we're missing a lot of it. Because the way they move, the way they deliver a message, you can tell somebody really bad news and they'll enjoy it if you say it the right way, right? Or if you really mean it, you know, in a gracious way. Or you can tell them good morning, then they'll hate you forever. But if they're not looking at you, they don't get the whole message. And so many times we misunderstood texts and emails because we're not looking at the person when they say it. And now with masks on, people can be sarcastic, but people don't realize they're being sarcastic. They just think they're horribly mean-spirited. So listen to see. And then the last one, listen to feel, is that connection with that person, how they feel inside. If you hear and see and feel them, it creates a bond. And how do we know this works? Because at the beginning of most relationships, one or the other will say, oh my God, I think you can read my mind. Now, these are the same people that are sitting talking to you 15 years later. He says, well, what happened to the mind reading part? And they say, well, he doesn't listen to me anymore. And he says, yes, I do. I hear you all the time.
You never stop talking. How can I not hear you?
Right. Or they're not watching you when you talk. So you're missing everything. So
yeah.
if people are on the verge of a bad relationship right now, maybe it's a little rough, take a moment, sit your spouse down, put your hands on each other's shoulders, and watch each other talk and really connect with how they feel. That could be a good tip to help people reconnect.
You know, that's really, really important because you find yourself in the divorce negotiation, whether it's just the two of you at the mediation table or with your attorneys at a settlement conference. Regardless, you go from, I thought I knew everything about this person, to who is the stranger sitting in front of me? But really and truly, your book is certainly about, you know, taking time to pause and creating the human connection. It sounds like you feel, you think that a human connection, maybe on a different level, can still be established during the divorce negotiation process, right? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Even though you've decided parting ways is the best thing because maybe it's a toxic relationship and it can be borne out in so many different ways.
Or you're just growing differently. It so happens after a long-term divorce.
Right. If you're in the mediation and you look at each other and really connect with each other as you go through it, it'll be a lot less hurtful. Hopefully it'll be mediated in a way where people can walk away and say, you know, we're still friends. We hear the stories of people that get divorced and we're still friends. We don't know how it works. And they're usually somewhere out there. They're not our neighbors or friends or anything.
Well, it's me. I'm still friends with my ex.
See?
It was a choice.
Professional though, so.
It was, well, at least that's the walk I can walk and the talk I can talk. You know, right. Everything else I may have to come. But that, for me, I was very proud of that. I won't talk about the issues surrounding the divorce or why surrounding the marriage, why we got divorced. There's stuff on both sides. You know, generally, there's just stuff on both sides.
Of course.
But I didn't want it to define us. I didn't want it to define the way I felt about him. And I kind of think he felt the same way. I do. Because maybe once a year or every other year, he's better at doing this than I. He'll just connect with me and say, hey, I've been following you on Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever. Sounds like you're really, you know, doing well, like what you're doing now, something like that. And I appreciated that.
That's a beautiful thing, and I'm jealous because I look at a speeding car coming my way. I have to make sure it's not one of my ex-wives driving it. Yeah, but that's enviable, and I wish that for everyone, because the opposite is horrible. It's just not good.
It really and truly is. So moving on, because there are so many wonderful things about your book, you talk about a technique called the tap and go technique.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
One of the things that I think about in any type of negotiation, we have to stay connected even though we're far apart. And the first thing is, if somebody's across the table from you, say your spouse, and the mediator is off to the side, you know, they can't sit in the middle, so they're probably sitting on either side, not, you know, not between you. Right. To make a point that's heartfelt and to try to regain a connection is just simply putting your hand out in the middle between you and tapping the table. Now, it's an interesting phenomenon. So sometimes, depending upon how volatile it is, if it's less than volatile, sometimes reaching out and just tapping their wrist or their hand as their hands are folded in front of you, just doing that, creating a slight connection there. And, you know, some people call me the connection guy or everything else. I think connection is so important right now, because connection heals mental health. It heals so many different things. But if you can just reach out and just tap somebody's hand just lightly and say, look, I understand how you feel about this. And I have felt that same way because we've been together for so long. Let's try this. All of a sudden, it's a great way to calm an otherwise potential volatile point. And then if you think tapping the arm might be too much, just a tap in the middle of the table. Just like, hey, I'm here. I'm still part of you. And you're reaching halfway across the table, because most of the tables are huge. You know, you're just going halfway, and just in a way, it's announcing, I'm halfway here. I'm right here within your grasp. The tap and go part is if you're getting up out of the room and you tap them on the shoulder and just say, I'll be right back, is a great way to just make that connection once more and solidify it and let them know, hey, I'm still with you. I'm right here. I'm going to be right back and think about this. We do that in sales a lot. I used to coach that a lot. And people were hard, you know, a little hard-pressed to try it. But some that did really found a secret in that. Because as you leave an office of negotiation and just say, okay, I'll be right back and do my best, that relationship extends to wherever you go and then waits until you get back. And that's what I found over the years of doing that. It really works well. It's an amazing thing.
So as you were talking, I was visualizing the mediation room and how something as subtle as what you just mentioned can truly work. So I'm thinking of a restroom break. In a 2 to 3 hour mediation, everyone's going to take a restroom break at some point. The person who has to walk around the other person to get out of the room, wonderful. All they have to do is slightly put the tips of their fingers or the palm of their hand on the other person's shoulder. I'll be right back. I can easily see how that would just melt them, the other person.
Absolutely.
I mean, just saying it and thinking about it makes me feel calmer. If you're the person next to the door and you don't have to pass the other person, yes, just extending your hand to the middle of the table, even if you can't reach the other person's hand, and just say, I'll be right back and we'll continue.
Yeah.
Yes, I can absolutely understand how that can work. Now, Kevin, you have another challenge.
What's that?
The challenge is these masks, the no shaking of hands rule that I hope is softening a little bit.
Yeah, when
the outgrowth of this pandemic, like the things that we were told to do to protect us health-wise, the first thing I went to is, oh my God, it's going to separate us as human beings. We need that physical connection. How are you looking at these health protocols in terms of human connection?
So as I work with NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, we have certain protocols to follow. But we also found out that connection is so important to mental health. The tsunami that is facing us is not the pandemic of the COVID or anything else like that. The tsunami of problems we have coming up on us is the connection, is mental health issues. Because people are getting shut off. They don't feel connected. You walk around the store with a mask on and stuff like that, what's happening? Nobody's saying hello. It's quiet. It's much quieter in the stores. You wait for a subway. You do anything else like that. If you're on a subway, everybody's quiet. They're not talking. It's part of it is like, don't say anything. It's an interesting phenomenon. But what I do is I look into their eyes. A lot of times people talk without looking into people's eyes. But if you make that connection visually and just say, how are you doing, and really wait for a moment and ask them, then that's something that's really important to do and something that would really help us.
And that's your nonverbal communication, right?
Exactly.
Communicating with your eyes.
Using affirmative stance, doing all the different things. Those are things that are something that that are really, really important for us moving forward.
And lastly, you have this section of the book that talks about the genius gift. What is the genius gift?
Well, that's one of the chapters, one of the favorite chapters of a gentleman that teaches TED Talks. And there is an assumption that I make, and I think it's real. As a matter of fact, I know it's real. I don't think it's real. There's a genius gift in all of us that is bigger than who we are. It's the essence of us. Wayne Dyer addresses it like, do what your passion serves you to do and the universe will pay you. Now, he doesn't really mean that the universe is going to send you money and stuff, but the universe pays you in a lot of different ways. Mm. If we serve the passion that's within us. Now, how do we know what our genius gift is? The genius gift is something that sets you apart from everyone else. It could be that you're extremely good at one chore or another. In the book, I talk about somebody that was doing stucco on the side of the wall, and it was like orchestrating, like he was an orchestra conductor, and he was doing, you know, music. It's something that's in you that comes so naturally and so beautifully that when you do it, you're at peace. When you do it, like painting, some people find painting too late in life. Writing a book, speaking with others. I am continually challenged to find my genius gift, and I think my genius gift is encouragement. And it doesn't have any specific name or anything. It could be anything. It could be painting. It could be encouraging people. It could be driving a car, whatever the case is. And the analogy that I use in the book is there's a janitor that cleans a bank in USA somewhere. And he does a great job cleaning the bank. It's his gift. That's what he does. And there's a CEO of the bank that can tell the janitor how to save more money. But he runs the bank. He does the numbers and everything else like that. So he's here. The janitor's there. But what the janitor can do is he can tell the CEO of the bank how to save as much money. I mean, how to save more money on how the lights go on and everything else like that. So that's his genius gift operating. The CEO can tell the janitor how to save more money than everything else they can. So the other thing about a genius gift, it makes us all equal. Because the CEO is not better or worse than the janitor, and the janitor is not better or worse than the banker. They're just different. They know different. They feel different. The genius gift is the thing that connects all of us. Because everyone has one. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're at. And how do you know how you have it? And how do you know what it is? Ask your friends. Ask the people that are around you. They'll tell you. You're naturally good at this or that or anything else. And try doing it over and over again. And as you do those things, you'll see time flies by. And you'll see extreme satisfaction afterwards as you're doing it. Because it comforts your soul. And that's what's so important during all that.
So two things. Remember the movie Moneyball?
Yes. Absolutely.
And so the genius gift of, I forget the wonderful actor's name who did all these what was his name?
I think it was Brad Pitt. No.
The guy who Brad had on his staff, some junior.
Oh, Jonah Hill.
Yes, Jonah Hill, who was just studying baseball, just studying it as a person. He really liked watching the numbers, and right. The numbers were inverted. The numbers were different than the managers and the owners of the baseball teams thought they should be looking at to buy different players to put a winning team together. And Jonah Hill, with his way of looking at numbers, comes in, the character, and says, I think you're doing it incorrectly. And everybody at the table of all these high-powered people says, who are you?
Right. Yeah, I love that analogy. I never drew that analogy in all the years I've been talking about the genius gift. It's a perfect example.
Yeah.
Because his genius gift changed baseball, and that's a true story.
Yeah.
So you never know when you become relevant, you know, if you stay within your place. And he was pointing out things that nobody ever recognized or saw. So, yeah, great analogy. Thanks. I'm going to use that again.
Please do. I steal from everybody I can think of if I find something cool. So now I'm going to relate what you said. And the other thing is to people getting divorced. So in a divorce, if both spouses don't have their own careers that they love and there's no reason to change, a fairly typical situation would be one spouse doesn't have a career.
Right.
Generally, the stay-at-home spouse, whoever it is. Or the spouse that was just told, listen, I make plenty of money. What do you have to work for? Maybe that spouse is married. I'm in Hollywood to a very wealthy film or television executive. So that spouse, it goes into the philanthropic arm of the family. But what I always say in these podcasts, in my mediations, is divorce is a new beginning. Divorce is an opportunity to restructure your life going forward. That can be the gift of divorce. And so with your genius gift, I think this is wonderful for people to be able to look at that as inspiration, because you're so beaten down sometimes with divorce. You feel like a failure. How could I have let this happen? All of that negative talk. But with your genius gift idea, this is an opportunity to really look at yourself and just say, well, what would make me get up in the morning happy, ready to roll, that I could do that, well, would more than likely earn a living? And it's weird. You know, the most creative people have taken something that they do naturally and made it into a career.
Yeah, and you see these people, they even tell you, I had no idea I could paint. I didn't know that I loved music as much. I didn't know I could learn how to play the piano in 2 months. I mean, there's all these things that come up and people say, hey, look at this, just amazing. And it's a beautiful thing. And, you know, when you're at that place, and maybe you're at that place right now as you listen to this, you know, don't give up hope, because there's a place for you. And it could be something you did in the past and forgot. It could be something that you reinvent yourself. But reinventing yourself is not as challenging as you would think.
Yeah.
Especially if you're following a passion that you're so excited about and you're like, oh my gosh, this is so important and I love this. Why not do this?
Yes. And because people need hope, because people need to know there's a bright future ahead, do not despair. Just figure it out. You have to figure it out. You know, divorce is a new beginning, a new opportunity. I think this is such an important message that cannot be diluted, and that is we each have something unique about us that we can share with the world. We just have to have the confidence to know we have something. And I liked what you said. If you can't figure it out on your own, talk to somebody who really knows you well.
Right. Absolutely.
And you would be surprised at how they look at you, right?
Right. They'll tell you things about, you know, if you, especially in times when you're in real duress, your close friends will sit down with you. And if you ask them that question, what do you think I should do, and wait for the answer and wait and see what they answer? What do you think? You know, because our jobs define who we are. If we're a homemaker, we're defined by that. If we're a salesperson or a mediator or anything else like that, we're defined by that. We need a definition of who we are. And when you're in a situation as stressful as divorce, as challenging as divorce, it's really important to decide, where do you go from here? and rely on the close friends that you have. And if you don't have too many close friends, you know, somebody you can actually trust their opinion. Your parents are going to direct it one way, your children are going to say something else, blah, blah, blah. And the guy that washes your car will say something else. But find somebody that you really have confidence in, maybe a mediator or somebody that really cares about you, and ask them those questions. What do you see me doing moving forward? What does it look like to you? Yeah, I think you'd really be surprised what kind of response you get, because people see you for who you are. And that could be a really valuable communication with them, or a very valuable connection.
Right. People see us for who we are in terms of without a filter.
Yes, and I want to add in there agenda. Watch for agenda-based comments. You know, if there's an agenda attached to somebody making a comment, then you know where it's going. So it could be a potential suitor. It could be somebody who either wants to take you down, build you up. It could be also a friend that you both had. Now you have, look for agendas. You want to have somebody that does not have an agenda when you ask this question, except to encourage you or to connect with you.
Right. If you are lucky enough to still have a childhood friend,
right,
or if you're very close to a sibling, that somebody who's grown up with you, who has seen you through thick and thin, has watched your ups and downs, these are the people who know who we are and what we project. That's what I wasn't thinking of.
Oh, I love that word.
Yeah, what we project, how we project it. And given the opportunity, they can be our best mirrors of self-reflection.
Yeah, because really at the end of the conversations you have with one another or people other than your attorney as a mediator, you know, people outside of this as you're going through these times, they could have an agenda or not, but you still have to look in the mirror. You still have to reflect on how it measured. You know, again, what will it serve? And stay calm and measured. And I think you can receive messages from people. And it really is. It will be one of the more challenging times that you go through. And I'll tell you that absolutely. It will be one of the most challenging times that you go through. But yeah, I will say that as we go through this, it will help us. As we go through life, it will help us. And at the end, when we come through this, if you pause and what will it serve, and you take 10 and all these different things out the other side of that, you'll come out a new person.
Without a doubt. And just the pausing to sum all of this up, and I love that you just did that. In terms of the filing process, the mediation process, the decision-making process, we have all this stuff swirling around. Yes, we may have to be thinking about, well, shoot, you know, I'm only going to have alimony for a few years. I better be thinking now about what I want to do. The taking 10, if you need to pause the decision-making portion of the divorce, pause.
Right.
You don't have to, next week, you don't have to make all your decisions next week. Be vocal about why you're pausing. I just need to get recentered so I can come back and we can finish. But you don't feel forced to get through all the decisions, because decision maker remorse will haunt you once you are divorced and you have that space and calm to reflect. I would hate for anybody to say, I wish I would have taken more time. I wish I would have thought this through better. Look what I just signed off on.
Well, and Judith, thank you for being who you are, because you know what? You're a person people can say that to. And I want to encourage people to do that. Say that you need time. This isn't a train wreck. This is something that has to be measured. This has to be done, calculated. Because if you don't, somebody's going to come out the other side wounded and hurt for years, and maybe financially ruined and have to recreate everything. You know, it's okay to hit the pause button. It's okay to take 10. Take a moment. Take a deep breath and walk away. I love it. Talk to Judith. Pull her aside.
Thank you for that. But don't take 10 before you go to Amazon and order Kevin's book. Take 10. So, Kevin, do you do public speaking, but if people wanted to contact you, are you available to talk? And in what context, and how do they get to you?
You have my contact information, but, you know, you can contact me through my email address is begreat44@yahoo.com. That's the last 7 chapters of my book is Be Great. So just like it sounds, begreat44@yahoo. You can pretty much connect with me through that. I look at my emails all the time. I ferret out all of the junk and I answer almost all the other ones that are there. And then I'm a pretty public person. I don't mind people reaching out to me because I reach right back. And also, if you order my book, if you order the ebook part of it, we're trying to sell 1,200 copies of my ebook by the end of the week. And it's $1.88 on special. So go to Amazon and go to Take 10 and you order the ebook. We're trying to sell 1,200 copies. So that would be great because that is set a goal to do that. But ebook or a regular book.
And by the way, I did try it out last evening. I wanted to prepare myself for today. And it was like seconds. I went online, I hit the link, and there was the app. It came right to me. That I can open up and use. So that's really great. Kevin, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us. I appreciate it more than you know.
Yeah, well, it's been a complete honor to meet you, Judy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank all of you for listening. You know I cherish each and every one of you. If you would like to get in touch with me, you can do it through my website, theamicabledivorceexpert.com, theamicabledivorceexpert.com. Please share this with your friends, anybody that you know who's about to embark upon a divorce, because I think the information that we give will help in the initial stages to prepare you for the best and most amicable divorce you can have. And as always, everybody, have an amicable week. We'll talk to you next week.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.